You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Misanthropy, Yo, the new wave of crime in social media, the hacking trial, did anybody win? BBC Two's Police Under Pressure reviewed, and we add two criminally outstanding tracks to the pretend iPod.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome back to the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. It's the Parish Council, of course. I'm Magnus Shaw, and Sky Rockets in Flight. It's your afternoon delight. It's Terence Beckham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, young man.
Hello there. Now, look, I just want to check something with you. You're not planning on biting anyone here today, are you? It's only I'd have to ban you for 9 podcasts and from all media-related activities for 4 months.
I'll leave that to your friends, the professional sports people, who are obviously exemplars of good behaviour.
Indeed they are, on the international stage as well.
Yeah.
What an example to the young people of the world.
Okay, that's quite interesting. I saw some, by no means scientific, but I saw some young people vox popped about this at a school the day after it happened, and they were all to a man without fail condemnatory. They thought it was dreadful. There's nothing about them that said I shall do that. They were all bitterly disappointed, so you know, that's encouraging.
That's good to hear. If only Luis Suarez felt the same.
Quite. I think
You know, I'd have some sympathy for him, because you know, it's obviously something that he at the moment can't control. Pediatricians and child psychologists say that it's probably something to do that he hasn't got over that childhood stage where many toddlers go through. Apparently it's fear and panic causes biting in toddlers, and in a given situation. I would have some sympathy for him if he didn't try and pretend it hadn't happened. And he's saying, oh, you know, what happened was my eye hit his chest. And, you know, if he just said, yeah, you know, I've got a massive problem here, I could really do with some help and support.
Well, if he at least did something about it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. His grandmother is in today's Telegraph being quoted as saying that he's being treated like a dog.
Well, and, yeah, funny you should say that.
Exactly, that's what I thought. But anyway, here's a thing, Magnus Shaw. I, in future, I'm seriously thinking of only leaving my house for emergencies.
Good policy.
Like, you know, going to lunch, perhaps. Because it doesn't ever go very well when I mix with what is generally known as other people, or I think the public, as they're sometimes called. Yeah. Last weekend, I went to see the Eagles at the O2. Indeed, I wrote about the experience in last week's Rocking
Vicar.
You did. But there was an incident, and we need to know that in common with many venues, the O2, it's understandable, they won't let you bring in bottled drinks into the arena, including bottled water. I imagine, you know, people could throw full bottles of stuff around, and, you know, you don't want that, really. So, and they do kindly provide big plastic beakers for free, and people can then pour their water into these big beakers, which, you know, is better than just confiscating.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I'm sure when I went to see Manic Street Preachers, which was the last time I was at the O2, I took a cup of tea in a cardboard cup, and that seemed to be okay.
Yes, it seems to be that if it's in a cup or a beaker, it's all right, but not in a bottle.
No,
anyway, we turned up on Friday night, row B, which, two from the front, obviously, second row from the front, fantastic. But to get into our seats, a couple at the end of the row had to stand up to let us pass by. And the woman bent down to pick up her handbag, forgetting, here it comes, that she had a full beaker of water in her hand. And it was like that Morecambe and Wise gag, you know, can you tell me the time? And he picks up his... At least the full beaker of water in her hand. She tipped it, and at least a pint all over the people in front, all over the floor, all over herself. And she was going, it's only water, it's only water. Because it did look and sound a bit like she'd had a terrible accident, you know, of a personal nature.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
And she was trying to reassure everyone around because, you know, people behind her along could just hear this sort of splashing noise as this woman was bending, you know. And so all these O2 security people came flying over. I mean, they were really nice. But they dashed off the net to find a mountain of paper towels.
Oh, well, that was nice. Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Everybody was really good about it. But yeah, so it was quite an entry to our seats. But I was just going to reflect on something that happened at the Eagles gig. What on stage? It was because I was expecting. It may just be me. I don't know if anybody else feels this way, but I was expecting the Eagles to be a bit sort of haughty,
right?
You know, a bit full of themselves. But they were so terribly humble and thankful to still be doing these gigs in their mid to late 60s. But the odd moment for me, I always believed that Don Henley is in charge of the Eagles. You know, what he says goes.
Yeah.
But during the introduce the band bit, Timothy B. Schmidt was there, you know, and on drums, and then he said, on guitar, keyboards and vocals, our leader, Glenn Frey.
Oh, okay.
And it was said with such definition,
felt,
you know, it was kind of rehearsed and said to be understood.
Yeah, I think these things are sorted out. I don't think they're ever ad-libbed, those moments.
Oh, there was. I tell you what, Magnus Shaw, there wasn't a moment. I mean, it was a lovely gig and it was great to hear the songs. But they could have been anywhere. It was rehearsed to, and every word and every there were no ad libs.
Yeah.
Every word between the songs was so clearly worked out and scripted.
Yeah, yeah.
They could have been in Berlin. they could have been in Cleveland. Yes. They could have been in Sydney, Australia.
Which
gives
rise to the Spinal Tap thing of not knowing which town you're in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know, there was that element to it, but they were lovely. But just going back on about, you know, the public and everything, back in 1666, when Molière staged the debut of The Misanthrope, his comedy of manners and hypocrisy in French society, he must have been a soothsayer, a seer into the future, because the very definition of misanthropy was to appear over 300 years later with me. Because, you know, I'm the 21st century misanthrope.
Yeah.
I just don't like mixing with people. I don't know about you. I can dine or lunch with a small group, maybe three or four at the most. But once it gets, you know, bigger than that, put me in a situation where I may have to integrate with thousands of people, like at the O2, or... as my next example, Magnus Shaw, last Monday, with strangers at the Royal Windsor Racecourse, I just lose all rationality. I've read another little anecdote for you. You know, Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell is other people.
Yes, he did,
He did in his play No Exit. And I'm inclined to agree with him, because we were in the posh bit. We were in the club enclosure at Windsor Racecourse last month. Actually, I wouldn't be in with the boy, but Lloyd, let's be honest. And it's an exclusive bit where you look right out onto the winning post.
Mm.
Sitting right behind me, this enormous bloke who couldn't stop sneezing. Now, did he use a hanky, a tissue, even his sleeve? No. He just exploded his sneezes into the environment of everyone within his range. Just like, whoa, Joe!
Yeah.
Like that. It was like Vesuvius erupting, you know, like mortar shells of virus being expelled into the winds of air. And, you know, that's why, I don't know if this is, you know, with you empathizers, that's why you can call me a misanthropist, because I'll happily wear that badge.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you. I mean, like I said, I agree with Sartre, other people. All our problems stem from the fact that we're sharing the planet with other people, don't they?
So, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And, but, I mean, I kind of describe it, I like specific people. An awful lot, and some specific people I love, but the concept of people is a different matter.
Isn't it? That's the definition. I think if we'd had to sum it up, that's exactly it.
It's the concept of people.
But specifically
on the sneezing man. I mean, I'm guessing it was hay fever this time of year.
I don't know. We all
sneeze from time to time, don't we? We hope that we haven't got a mouthful of food when we do it, but we take precautionary measures, don't we? It's invasive action, and clamp something to our faces, and if we can't stop, and we go away somewhere and do it where it's less offensive. But public transport, planes and trains are just, particularly on a plane, as you've got no option to sit anywhere else. So you've got somebody 2 seats behind you having a 2-hour sneezing session. And you just know that you're a couple of days away from falling ill. There's nothing you can do about it.
That was exactly my thoughts. You know, and I thought, in the Desert Island Discs, if someone stuck me on a desert island, I wouldn't even need the 8 gramophone records. At least no one would be sneezing on me. I'd be quite happy in that solitude. And I wondered about the future. I thought maybe Michael Jackson had the right idea when he used to go around wearing a surgical mask.
Yeah,
people thought he was eccentric, but I might adopt that look.
Well, it's very popular with the Chinese and Japanese, isn't it? Particularly the Chinese, I think. I mean, they have appalling pollution problems, so that's the primary reason. But I think there's also, it's socially acceptable to wear something across your face because everybody knows that's how germs are acquired.
I can see it coming here. You're right. You can't see a photograph of people joining the subway system in Tokyo without noticing that about half of them are wearing white surgical masks.
Yeah, nobody thinks that's
nobody
unusual.
Thinks twice.
I mean, it would hear. People would think you're in Alternates. You remember the band Alternates?
Yes, who wore those,
didn't they? The only people you see wearing them in this country, I think, are cyclists and cycle messengers in London, where for obvious reasons. But with your racecourse friend hopping around the place, there's every reason to invest in a pack of surgical masks. Yeah,
I was very seriously thinking. I did have a kind of straw hat, like a Panama type hat, because it was boiling hot, and it was because of the sun. You can picture the scene, kind of. And I was like wearing that as low at the back as I could, so that I was hoping it would attract his sneezes rather than me breathing it in.
Well, I've been in on a similar situation on a train with somebody sat directly behind me, giving it beans with the old sneezing, and actually realised I could feel the spray hitting the back of my neck.
Oh, God.
I could feel the droplets landing on me.
This planet would be great without other people.
Without other people, yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
I've got one thing to say to you, Magnus, and that is, yo. Yo, it's a new social media app which enables people to say yo to each other. This has gone wild over the last week or two, especially in America. It's really taken off in the States. The app has been downloaded by 1 million users, and last week 4 million yos were sent in one day. So with capital investors backing yo to the tune of $1 million, are you an early adopter of yo, Magnus?
I read about this and wondered if it wasn't a spoof, because it seems singularly retrograde. We can already send each other as complex messages as we want over SMS or over what's the other thing that's really popular, the
BBM, the BlackBerry thing?
No, the
Twitter.
Yeah, well, there is Twitter as well. Yeah, yeah. No. The it'll come to me anyway. The thing that they're all using these days, it's an instant message platform where you can type whatever you want and it appears on
WhatsApp.
Thank you very much. It appears on somebody else's phone. So why would we want to then handcuff ourselves to sending somebody just 2 letters, a Y and an O? And on receipt of the 2 letters, what's the other person supposed to do other than send the same thing back? And I was reading the founders, the inventors of this thing said, just imagine the commercial opportunities. If you're an online vendor, you can announce that you have a sale to your subscribers by sending them all a yo. So no, you can't. You can't announce anything, because all you can do is hit a button that sends yo to them. So they go, I've received this from buynicethings.com. But I don't know what to do now because they can only send me two letters and two specific letters at that. It seems extraordinary. And $1 million investment. That's also another puzzler, isn't it, really? Because yeah. I understand it, the person who's invested is a close friend of the inventor, so it's not exactly on the open market, this investment. But and this kind of goes for a lot of these applications. It's like, how would you realise your money back? Even if there's 1 billion users daily sending yo's to each other, how does that generate revenue? I can't see how it possibly does, unless you get an ad with your yo, in which case, you know, you might as well use another platform that sends more than two letters and doesn't send an ad. I don't get it. I don't understand it. And I think that the article I was reading pointed quite gently towards this as evidence of a sort of a new generation of dot-com bubble, you know, an app bubble where people can invent pretty much anything. And if they charm the right people, they'll throw buckets of money at it, which is, you know, a recipe of disaster in the end when they all fail.
Well, yes, we've been down that road before. The people behind Yo, on their website, I had a look at their website, they say, if you want to say, I'm thinking about you to your love, or you want to say, are you up yet? Well, just say Yo.
No, you don't, do you? You say, are you up yet? I still don't understand the linguistic logic of this. So how's that person supposed to know that yo means are you up yet?
Well, I wondered whether there's a cultural divide here, whether it's an Americans would recognize, because American people, well, some American people do use the expression yo. It's not something that we say in England very much, unless we're being kind of ironic or you know, trying to be hip or cool or something.
Well, yeah,
we don't, yeah. Do we? I mean,
well,
I don't go around.
It's hip hop speak, isn't it? It came from hip hop. I mean, you think that. The first Public Enemy album was called Yo Bum Rush the Show, wasn't it?
So could it be that Americans would interpret the receiving yo as a kind of wake-up call, or that something inherent in their culture is different to us? Where, as you say, if you or I received a message saying yo, you'd think, yeah, and?
Yes, well, I'd be terribly frustrated not to be able to send back, yes, what would you want? I understand that somebody sending yo is a, I'm trying to contact you, you know, I get it that far, but you can't go back and say, yeah, what do you want?
what if you were, you know, you were a busy young executive bustling in New York's busy money markets, okay, and Mrs. the Magnashaw was equally busy in the Hamptons, you know, in her real estate business.
She'd be a realtor. My sister is in the Hamptons as we speak.
Now, what if you didn't have the time? You know, you were moving billions of pounds and dollars worth of money about the stock markets of the world, and you just wanted to say to Mrs. the Magnashaw, my love for you is as strong today as it has been these last years, you know, that you've put up with me. And instead of being, you know, you didn't have time to say all of that, so you just press a purple button on this app that says yo, and she would know, oh well, it's not an emergency because he's not phoning me or he's not texting me to say that the house is burning down. So she would interpret that as like, ah, he's thinking of me.
No, she would rightly interpret that as he's not really thinking of me because he hasn't got time to send anything other than this dumb monosyllabic hip hop sobriquet. Yeah. It still doesn't get you anywhere. You don't convey anything except I pressed this button.
But you're right, it is sort of as efficient and subtle as a punch on the nose, isn't it? You know, but you see, remember when you first, I don't know about you, have you tried to explain Twitter to people maybe 5 years ago, maybe more, and they said, oh, that's crazy, why would that catch on?
Oh, yeah, no, and we've admitted it as much, haven't we, that if somebody was pitching Twitter and we were in the room, we would say, I don't get it. You know, I absolutely, because, you know, the idea that you can send messages to an audience or to an individual, but you can only use 140 characters. It does sound restrictive and a bit pointless until you try it. But the thing is, this is genuinely, genuinely restricted. And, you know, it has been tried. And as expected, people can send two letters to each other, two specified letters to each other. And that really is as far as it goes. I mean, yes, in extremis, you could say, but Magnus, you haven't tried yoing, and so maybe I should before I pass comment. But as I completely understand what's involved, I can't see how it can possibly become compelling.
I suppose a two-way conversation on this could be called a yo-yo, couldn't
it?
But you see, maybe
a wooden yo-yo would be far more stimulating.
Far more thrilling, wouldn't it?
But what do you do? I send you, Terence, yo.
Yes. Yeah.
You open up your yo app, and you can see I've sent you a yo, and you hit the purple button, and it comes back yo. And then what do I do? Send you another one. And how long does that proceed?
Imagine that, like, for 12 hours during the day, just constantly sending yo back.
If you smoked sufficient number of jazz cigarettes, it might become quite hypnotic. But other than that, you can't take the yes, it makes contact with whoever you've picked from your contact list. You've made contact. You can't take it any further. Every other application available, including speaking to each other on the telephone, progresses from the initial contact. This can't. It has no ability to do that.
Well, all I can say is maybe this time next year we'll all find 140 characters just too tiring.
Too many characters.
Too many. And we'll all be saying y'all to each other through the
Yeah, two character Twitter. Two specified characters.
Yes, that's right. As I say, we're writing it off, but you know, some people or person, they've pumped $1 million into it.
Yeah.
So good luck with that investment,
can we create an alternative, you know, one that sends the word...
I'd have meh.
That would be more entertaining, actually. Yeah.
I'd just send you my meh. You'd just be sitting there, go bing. No, it would have to be a kind of depressing kind of sound. It'd probably just go...
A sigh, a groan, yeah.
Yeah. And then you open it up and it'd be me going... Meh.
Well, that would be much more English, yes. And it would at least make you think, I wonder what he's being disparaging about now. I run down a list of things you might be doing that have failed to impress you. But yo doesn't have that air of mystery at all.
We'll
invent the meh app, which requires one more character but somehow conveys much more feeling,
Anybody who wants to invest $1 million, could be in touch.
Just shout.
We'll consider your offer. In a few minutes, Magnus Shaw, we'll be looking at the pressure a specific police force is under in our TV review. But ahead of that, it was reported widely this week that, and I must say I found this absolutely astonishing, complaints arising from Twitter, Facebook and other social media, presumably not Yo. these complaints from social media make up at least half of the calls passed on to police officers. It's an astonishing rise. Chief Constable Alex Marshall said this on BBC Radio 4's Law in Action this week. And if we assume it to be true, Magnus Shaw, then we may need to recruit a new police force just to deal with people making threats on Twitter.
This is actually getting quite serious now, isn't it? And
it's
mired in all sorts of problems. I suppose as an amusing aside, is that this is one advantage of the Yo app, isn't it? Is you can't go into a police station and say, look, I'm being really badly harassed on social media. And they say, well, what's the person saying to you, sir? Just Yo. But nothing else. No, they can't say anything else. I think police can cross that one off the books pretty quick.
Yeah.
But, there's so many aspects to this. Firstly, we kind of do need to impose some boundaries on social networking and communication so that it doesn't become a dangerous and unhealthy environment. But I know that I'm pretty certain that's not the job of the police, simply because I don't think the police really fully understand the technology and the implications of the technology. And why should they? You know, they really have a lot on their plates these days, with reduced budgets and headcounts. I'm sure they don't have the time or the inclination to go and get fully trained up on social media. So I think, you know, it's for the online community, to use a dreadful phrase, to try and come up with some solution to this. But as well, there seems to be a tendency for people to rush to the police every time something in their life happens that they're not too keen on. Which now I know there are people who have received messages on social media that are illegal, that are criminal, but if half of all police calls are people complaining about social media, that has to go beyond people who are receiving, you know, terrifying threats. There must be people phoning up saying, oh, my boyfriend says he doesn't fancy me anymore. There must be a lot of that going on, which, you know, throws up all sorts of other questions. Is like, how do we defuse people's propensity to go running to the police when they read something on Facebook that they don't like? And if the police respond, then that gives people the incentive to fit people up over social media. You know, or you posted a picture of me drunk last Saturday. Right, I'll get you. Phone the police. You know, and I don't think the police are equipped to deal with it. And in most cases, nor should they really be expected to.
Do you know, you're absolutely right, because I've actually heard an anonymous officer quoted yesterday, and he said that a lot of calls to the police are spurious. And it's exactly what he's saying. He said that complaints are made, and this is what he said, because people don't know what to do, they can't handle their own troubles, so they turn to the police for a solution. That's exactly what he said, which is essentially what he's saying. But do you know what I was thinking when I saw this story? It reminded me that 2 years ago, because I remember it was during the London Olympics, which of course is just short now, two years ago, we were talking about threats that the young diver Tom Daly received from some young, you know, ne'er-do-well from down in the West Country somewhere. And we haven't got any further forward. In fact, we've probably gone backwards since then. And this Chief Constable, Alex Marshall, he said that his feeling is that as people move shopping and communications online, so they move their insults, abuse and threats with them. And he said that there are now 6,000 officers. When you think of what we're going to be talking about shortly, about the shortfall of officers in a particular police force for our TV review shortly, 6,000 officers are now being trained to deal with online offences.
I suppose it depends how you define online offences. You know, if somebody is sending out a misleading advertisement which will deprive naive users of, you know, large sums of money, then, you know, that's fraud. You take remove the platform, that's, you know, old-fashioned fraud, and that needs the police to intervene. So it depends what you mean by an online offence, but if it is simply sending a message saying, you know, I think you look like a horse's backside, then the police have no interest in that. Indeed, nor does anybody else. And that's what concerns me, that is now becoming a borderline offence. And I think another concern, whilst I'm, you know, condemning people wasting police time, I think to some extent, the police and certainly the prosecutors, the legal profession, are now bearing down on online messaging, which actually doesn't have a criminal aspect to it, just merely a distasteful aspect to it, or a cruel aspect to it. But none of those things really have ever been exposed to the weight of the law. I'm thinking about the admittedly disgusting messages that were sent when the school teacher in West Yorkshire was stabbed to death a few weeks ago, and a couple of people, certainly one person, was exposed to the full weight of the law, and I think maybe enjoyed some time at Her Majesty's pleasure as a result. I wonder whether that is criminal behavior. Are we not free to be obnoxious and stupid online, providing we don't step into, you know, murderous or violent intent?
Well, the Daily Mirror ran a poll yesterday, online as it happens, and 57%, I checked, 57% said, it's not a big majority, 57% said the police spend too much time on social media investigations. But then I thought, well, tell that to Stella Creasy and Caroline Criado-Perez, who got those appalling threats simply for wanting to suggest that Jane Austen could appear on Bang.
And Mary Beard as well. But I think it's quite, it was clear in my mind as to when somebody being an idiot crosses over into somebody being criminally reckless, and that doesn't have to be online. You know, if I come round your house tonight and start yelling through the letterbox that I've got a large knife or a gun or a can of petrol or whatever, and I'm going to do you in, that is illegal. That's criminally reckless and it's threatening behaviour. If I simply go on Twitter this evening and say, the Terence is the ugliest person since the Elephant Man, then I think, you know, people would think that was an idiot and juvenile and obnoxious.
And untrue.
But I don't think that's a matter for the police or the courts.
You're supposed to say, and it's untrue as well.
Well, that's, yeah, the jury's out on that. I think brickbats, no matter how ill-considered and hurtful, don't necessarily have a place in the courtroom.
Well, okay, let's just look at it this way. Katie Hopkins, she's a big presence these days on Twitter, and she says, well, she shrugs it all off. I mean, she gets an incredible amount of abuse. She posts up, quite extreme opinions, and she says, well, I do that. I'll take whatever you want to throw back at me, whatever, Now, that's one thing. A friend of mine... it's difficult this, but I'll spell it out. A friend of mine is actually happens to be married to Michael Gove, the Secretary of State for Education. She's called Sarah Vine. She's a journalist with the Times.
Yeah. Right?
And Sarah often... I've never met Michael Gove in my life, I should say. Now, she often, under her own name, she puts it under her own name. For example, last night she was commenting on Question Time and happened to say, she said, John Prescott, he's a clown in a suit. I think so. She's entitled to say that. A little bit kind of rude, but, not terrific. But when I then looked at the replies that she was getting to that, most of them were in relation to her husband and not to her. But many of them were so vicious that, in response to a mild-mannered comment about, John Prescott, he's a bit of a clown. And because when you vaguely know someone, it seems to hit harder. And I actually really did upset me to think that she's sitting at home with the children upstairs, the dog at her feet, and she's having to wade through... pages of abuse.
No, I agree. I don't think that's an issue that doesn't deserve consideration. I mean, my point is, should that end up in a courtroom, or is it something for us as a society to weigh and balance and find some sort of mitigation, some way of prevention? Well, we've certainly said before, and I'm always rather conscious of repeating ourselves on podcasts, especially as we're of a certain age and can never remember what we've said before. But I think we've said this before, but it does bear repeating. Surely it is now time for some kind of online passport whereby through unintrusive measures, but you prove your identity just in the same way as you would if you wanted a passport to travel abroad or a driving license or a fishing license or whatever. You prove who you are. You get some kind of unequivocal profile. And then having... obtained this, you are free within the law to roam the avenues of the internet, saying, doing, and exploring whatever the hell you like. Because if you then display yourself to be an oaf, juvenile, ignorant, vicious, stupid, then that is traceable very quickly, very easily back to you. Now, I'm not saying that and therefore you're prosecuted. What I'm saying is you expose yourself for what you are to all and sundry. And I think that would go a long way to calming all this down. It wouldn't stop it, but I think it would calm it down. I think people are abusing the anonymity that is offered to them by social networks and by the internet. And I think people think, oh, God, you know, if my gran or my mum, and you know, let's make no bones about it, lots of people doing this would be terrified if their mum knew they were doing it. Mm. You know, it doesn't matter if they're 12 or 30, they're just the kind of people who would be terrified of their mum finding out. And you know, their neighbours, friends and colleagues would find out if their comments were traced back to their online identity, their verified online identity. I don't see a problem with that. I don't think it's an invasion of civil liberties. I think it's a collective agreement that we all have absolute freedom of speech, but it's ascribable to you. And if you don't want what you say to be ascribable to you, then you shouldn't say it.
I'll go along with all of that, except that I'd like some sort of kind of payback for it as well, so that if you've actually gone over the line, and if you've said something on Twitter or Facebook or any social media outlet, that if you said it on the street in the hearing of a policeman, he'd arrest you, then I would like you to, you know, have to do something, you know, go and clean the rubbish out of the playground or
fences. To an extent, I mean, if you're audibly profane in the streets, that is technically an offence. But if you use the F word, the C word, and all the other words on Twitter, then you know it's a different setting. It's a different framework. So I'm not sure that, you know, the two things have total parallels. But yes, I think if you break the law online by threatening to hurt people or to bring a mob round to somebody's house or to burn a building down or whatever, absolutely, of course. And it wouldn't be such a task for the police to come and get you, because you are having to use an online identity that's verifiable.
Well, staying with the law for a couple of topics now, and this week has seen the conclusion of the phone hacking trial after a considerable period of time, and some people found or pleaded guilty and some not guilty, and there's been a lot written and spoken about the phone hacking scandal and the inquiry by Lord Justice Leveson. But I thought it would be a good moment. I wanted to wait till the end of the whole process to relate a story told to me by she's a friend of mine. She's a very well-known actress. I'm not going to say who she is, which may be very frustrating, but there's a reason for it. And she's often followed by photographers. And two or three months ago, we had lunch, and she was telling me what she went through at the height of her fame. Mm-hmm. She's still famous, but not quite so much these days. Paparazzi she was involved in the phone hacking thing as well. Paparazzi would trail her all day, everywhere she went. The moment she left the house, maybe up to a dozen, usually working in pairs. One would drive a scooter or a motorbike, mm-hmm. and the other one would be the photographer. And their aim was to take her photo in an unusual situation, because newspapers and magazines weren't really interested in a photograph of her just in, you know, smiling photo as she comes out of a shop or something. Mm. So they waited until she bent over to pick up her handbag, for example, mm-hmm. something like that. And when she returned home, there would be another, I don't know, dozen or so paparazzi waiting along her street that she lived. And they're so desperate to get her to react, to get a photo of her reacting, so they could get a photo of her looking like really like she's crying or angry or you know, making some sort of gesture, distress sort of thing. They would swear at her, swear about her family, her partner, her mother, call her really terrible names, and actually they would actually spit at her and throw things at her to try and provoke a reaction. And when she was telling me this, she said it in such a sort of calm, everyday, matter-of-fact way. But it used to happen to her every day during this the worst aspects of press behaviour until the some of these newspapers were taken at least a little bit in hand when Lord Justice Leveson started his inquiry. And, such the sort of price of celebrity, the cost of fame,
I think there are certain costs to fame and having a high profile. Not least of all, people recognising your face, as you go about your business. That's inevitable. That's a sort of the definition of fame, isn't it?
Mm.
But that sort of behaviour is not the price of fame. My burning question would be, where the hell were the police? Where the hell were the police? That is not legal. Nobody under the law is expected to tolerate that kind of behaviour. So where the hell were the police?
Well, I suppose if my friend was going through that, then people we can certainly name Amy Winehouse now as someone who's sadly no longer with us. I'm sure she went through the same thing where, often used to see photos of paparazzi all standing outside her house in Camden, and if they were going through it, then I'm sure there's probably 50 other, 100 other personalities in London, and I suppose the police would say, well, we can't trail around all of them all the time, but I take your point.
But they don't appear to trail the police of this activity, if it's still going on, and certainly in the case of your friend, there was no intervention whatsoever. She's a lone young woman who is perfectly entitled both morally and legally to expect the protection of the law, and everything you've described there is A, immoral, B, intolerable, and C, illegal. And that's the question that raises. It doesn't surprise me at all the depths to which people will stoop in order to get a paycheck. I'm afraid, the drive for money makes people behave in extraordinarily bad ways. What does astonish me is that, there was no intervention from the police or other quarters to prevent this from happening. That is sickening.
The lasting memory of her anecdote with me is that she'd told of nights where she was coming home, an ordinary night out, and would have to take her shoes off and then run down her road to her house to try and get ahead of these blokes throwing stuff at her to try and take photos of her. But that's what.
And yes. Yet, had she retaliated, had she picked up a rock and pranged some guy on the back of a motor scooter, I don't know, but I feel fairly certain that the police would have visited her forthwith.
Undoubtedly, and it would have been front page news with accompanying photographs, of course.
Most concerning, and I don't think anybody would think that was anything they wanted from the relationship between celebrities and the press.
No. Well, in terms of, we're talking about the police there, in terms of public service, we're told we're living in an age of austerity, cuts in budgets affect every aspect of including, I suppose, local authorities, hospitals, schools, the civil service and the police force. And it was the impact of financial restraint that was the focus of Police Under Pressure, a two-part documentary, the first episode of which was shown on BBC Two on Monday. And the programme looked at the difficulties in policing South Yorkshire, your neighbourhood, Magnus.
Well, I live in North Derbyshire, but the two back onto each other, absolutely they do. And the setting for this documentary is not far from where I live, far enough, thankfully, for it the events there to not impinge on me at all. But it's not far away. First thing to say, I thought this was a very, very good documentary. I thought it was all the bells and whistles had been stripped away. There were no special effects. There was very little sort of doom laden music, and it wasn't dressed up in any sort of modern television way. It was a pretty raw, pretty gritty account of an enormous social problem happening, more or less right now. all that said, it's probably the most frustrating piece of television I've ever seen, because it was far from being glib. It just presented some almost intractable difficulties that for which there seemed to be no easy solution. If you see a documentary about the poaching of elephants, you think it's heartbreaking, extraordinarily sad and wrong, but you can sort of see the solution is to rein in the poachers, etc., etc. This was just so interwoven. The problems were just so interwoven and came from so many different quarters and were being presented by so many different societal groups that it was impossible to be glib about what you'd seen and say, oh, well, I'll tell you what they need to do. The problem was that at no point could you say, I'll tell you what they should do. It was impossible to see what anybody should do. For people who didn't see it, it was two estates in South Yorkshire, both of them plagued by what is called antisocial behaviour. I think everybody knows what that means now. But broadly speaking, involved groups of vaguely unsavoury people, certainly unsavoury in groups, hanging about the streets late at night, making a noise, and indeed, in some cases, presenting a threat to local businesses and the well-being of the community. On the other side of the fence were the police, who were being lent on very hard by the people who control the police, Home Office, etc., to do something about this. But to do something about this, we're on a massively reduced budget with a massively reduced headcount. It would just the resources to not even tackle a tenth of it. And we just saw how the community and the police were presented with these problems and how they wrestled with them, and how the back reference, the elephant in the room was, this is insoluble with our current resources. It was sticking plasters. It was putting the wallpaper back over the damp patch over and over and over and over again. Frustrating and massively depressing.
People often use a phrase that has become such a cliche about moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. But it's apt in this case, isn't it? Because that's what they were doing. They were kind of moving all the officers to go and deal with a problem in a different part of East Sheffield, which then left another part of East Sheffield completely vulnerable.
And because the community sprang up and said, where have all our policemen gone? As you would. If you remember in Tom and Jerry, when Jerry Mouse would hit Tom with a large mallet and a bump would rise up on his head, and so Tom would press the bump back down into his head and it would rise up on the other side of his head.
That's exactly what was happening.
The problem with it was, even given another 50-100 officers, that wasn't really the point. Who wants 100 police officers in their community every night just to make sure that you can go and get fish and chips without being assaulted? That's not a solution, is it? That's not a picture anybody wants either. It's that's what I mean. It's so ingrained. What the police were trying to deal with were symptoms, and they couldn't even deal with that. But the actual societal disease lay deep below all that. Horrendous, horrendous.
It is. It doesn't help the people now, but the cyclical nature of this struck me, because a generation ago, without doubt, and by the way, people were called white British in this documentary. That's the term I'm going to use to differentiate between different parts of the community. White British a generation ago would have said, these Pakistanis come in here, changing our way of life with their way of life and their cooking and their mosques. Mm. And now the Pakistanis and the white British were united. The Pakistanis, it seemed to me, had fully integrated as much as one could with the sort of white British community, and they were like as one. united against this, what was called, the word was used, influx of 700 Roma families.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, I it just made me think that in 50 years' time, were you and I still to be here, which undoubtedly we won't, to be talking about this, there'll be a documentary where the Pakistani, white, British and Roma families are all together against the Martians,
yeah.
who've come, to integrate into South Yorkshire. Inspector Simon Lee seemed a pleasant young man, young to me to be an inspector, but he didn't have any answers at all. Why should he, of course? Because he had targets to meet in relation to reducing antisocial behaviour. He had to go on one of those dreadful telephone conference calls every day to his superiors, and it was all about targets, not policing, as we would define it. His aim for the next day or the next week was to reduce the numbers of reported antisocial behaviour. Not to do good policing, to get into the community and stop crime, but to reduce numbers.
Absolutely.
So that his targets went from red on a spreadsheet, I imagine, to amber. Well done for your target. But what a world away it seemed to me. Grimy, litter-strewn streets that Dickens or Hogarth would have recognised at once. You could have shown either of those two people a snapshot of the streets around Parson Cross, and they would have, nothing's changed then since my time, they would have said. And it all seemed to be that they relied on this tool called Section 30, which was a dispersal of groups. It meant not more than two people could gather. And rather, this is where we've come to. We don't have the resources nor the energy to sort out what's causing all these issues. What we do instead is just say to groups of people, move on, which is what this Section 30 does. You can't congregate here, move on. One thing seemed to me to where the perhaps, of course, there were young hoodlums who deserved to be treated quite strictly, in my view, but I would say that. But one of the issues seemed to be that the sort of older, last generation people were worried because other families were on the streets. But perhaps in Slovakia, where many of these people came from, and perhaps in the hottest parts of Pakistan, maybe you do stand out on your front porch at night or in the street chatting to people because it's what you do.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Slovakia is not all that hot, but culturally, perhaps that's what you do. Yes, yeah. But which to my mind required some kind of public congregation where everybody expressed what they wanted out of the community, and everybody gave a little ground. They just seemed so far from getting close to that. When there was a public meeting, it excluded the Roma community and actually attracted the English Defence League.
Yes,
was just you know, you thought, I might, you know, as if there weren't problems enough, here come the the card carrying racist ballyhoos, you know.
They didn't seem to help at all.
Of course
they
didn't. Of course they didn't. They were seeing a reasonable sized bonfire and were turning up to throw diesel on it. It was the last thing any of those people needed. I think, you know, more than what the Romans were or were not doing was the really frustrating point came for me when there were a group of young boys, and they were boys, 14 or 15, who seemed to have the upper hand over all the adults, and worse still, over the police. They could tell the policewoman that they were going to kick her head in. They could shout in through the window of the police van. They could go into the local takeaway restaurant and shout racist abuse and flick fag ends in, and all this, you know, whatever it was they would do. They assaulted a customer who was waiting to collect his food. He left before he could get his food because he was frightened. These boys were 14 and 15. How did we get to the point in 21st century Britain where we handed all the power to 14 and 15 year old boys, a notorious ridiculously unstable and stupid section of, and I include myself in that section of the community. You know, if there's one strand of society that needs to be kept on a short leash, it's 14 and 15 year old boys, and we are scared of them. I would never in a million years, when I was 15, would I have leaned in through the window of a police van and told a policewoman I was going to kick her head in. I wouldn't have had. No, I mean, you know what I'm saying. Bravado doesn't come into it. I would have been more likely to set my own hair on fire than to do that, you know?
Yes, I sort of made a few bullet points as I was watching it, and one of them that I wrote down was laissez-faire policing, because it seemed to be completely non-interventionist. Yeah. As you rightly describe it, these twerpish youngsters were ruling the streets,
yes,
and the police appeared to be powerless and acknowledged that they were powerless. They actually said, there's nothing we can do. They got in their cars and drove off, leaving those poor people trying to run a takeaway shop, trying to run a legitimate business in a desperately, you know, time of austerity and economic challenges, left them on their own.
But
and
again,
every time
as we said about your friend, had the business owner appeared out of the front of his shop with a large kebab knife in order to disperse these young men, suddenly the police would have, found all the powers they needed. That's, I mean, I hate to sound like the Daily Mail, but those were the facts, weren't they?
Very much so. And the chap, Simon Leek, the inspector, the chief inspector, he made me think of a man with a bucket of water trying to put out a forest fire. You know, he had all the aims and he had all his key work objectives and his competences and his targets and, you know, all of his spreadsheets and whatnot. But the long and the short of it is that no matter how many hours he spent poring over those spreadsheets and how many times he checked what his targets were, he still only had this bucket of water to put out a fire that was raging through his entire district.
And outrageous that those above him paid considerably more than him and with considerably more authority and responsibility than him should allow his job to come down to that. You know, shame on them. Shame on them.
I couldn't do his job, not that I'd ever be invited to, but I couldn't do his job nor the job of the police on the streets, because I would just find it so frustrating because you have no answers and there's nothing you can do. There's just nothing to be done. The only bit where I take issue with it is my old problem. Maybe this is me, because I say this every single time. It's a usual issue for me. The programme, I just felt it was too long. The point was well made, but I just felt it could have been made in 30 minutes. An hour simply led to repetition of the same point.
Yeah, possibly, but I did think in this instance it drew you into a very bleak world, and I think the longer it held you there, the more you felt the palpable futility and frustration that was in it. For me, it wasn't too long, because I think you needed to be engrossed in that dark frustrating world, which is just up the road from where I'm speaking to you now, unfortunately, in a very different part of this area, but it was emotionally taxing, but a very good documentary.
This was episode one of two parts. The episode one was Uneasy Peace. The program is called Police Under Pressure. It was narrated by Stephen McIntosh, produced and directed by Louise Malkinson. Now, it's on the iPlayer if you're in the United Kingdom for a few more days. But if you'd like to see the second part, that's being shown on Monday, June 30th, BBC Two at 9:00 p.m. Mm. Police Under Pressure. Mm. Now, Magnus Shaw, I was just distracted there because I've just been given a message that Don Henley from the Eagles, Luis Suarez from the Uruguayan national team, Lord Justice Leveson, and the bloke who kept sneezing at Royal Windsor Racecourse, they've all been in contact and said that they're going to watch the second episode of Police Under Pressure. But they're saying, Don't let that, though, make sure we leave enough time, they're saying, for the pretend iPod. So we better move on to that now, the pretend iPod, where we choose a bit of music, tell you why we like it, and it joins a gigantic playlist. Oh, my God, it's overwhelmingly huge on the Rocking Vicar website. And it's also available on Spotify under, I believe, your name, Magnus Shaw. And something on him. When I was very little and listening to the Beatles, I thought records were magical things, objects that just arrived in the shops. I had no idea of the process that led to their appearance in record stores. And similarly, with the songs on the records, I figured they arrived in the minds of John Lennon and Paul McCartney in a dream or in a vision. Like Catholic saints believing they hear voices from heaven guiding their way, so I felt it was with John and Paul. It just never occurred to me that there was work involved in creating a song and that Paul, John actually sat down at a piano or with a guitar and took inspiration from elsewhere.
Well, it's sort of the case of Yesterday, which I think did arrive fully formed in a dream, didn't it?
Did it really?
Yes.
Is that how Paul wrote Yesterday, in a dream?
Paul woke up and he had it fully formed in his head, which he didn't have when he went to sleep. Yes.
Which is, of course, how these podcasts are appearing.
Yeah, I think people would easily believe that.
It was one or two of my older cousins who explained to me how much the Beatles were influenced in their writing by American acts, especially soul and particularly Motown. And they even covered Motown songs on the early first couple of albums. And, of course, in their live act during their steep learning curve in Hamburg. And I can remember way back then my cousins and my dad explaining when I was wearing out the B-side to I Want to Hold Your Hand, they explained that this boy was John Lennon trying to sound like an American group, the song This Boy. And he was trying to sort of almost take reference from the Miracles and their lead singer, Smokey Robinson. And so I began to try and find as many Motown records as I could, and especially Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. You Really Got a Hold on Me, and the wonderful Ooh Baby Baby. I loved everything I heard. Smokey Robinson was a world away from me in my suburban town, and Detroit might have been on Mars for all I knew. But there was something enormously exciting about seeing that Motown label on the record player, and something so sweet and emotional with Smokey Robinson's honey-coated, plaintive voice. Now, with Smokey, I could have chosen almost any of his work to show his glorious vocals, but here's the track I've selected, featuring the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, recorded in Detroit, Michigan in 1965. It was released June 23rd, 1965 in the USA, but it wasn't released in the United Kingdom until 1969, so 4 years later. It reached number 16 on the Billboard Top 200, number 9 on the UK Top 40, 2 minutes and 55 seconds, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, The Tracks of My Tears.
Yeah, it's one of those rare occasions, isn't it, where the songwriter and the performer are one and the same person, and they seem to excel to a breathtaking extent in both arts. It's a remarkably well-written and crafted song, and beautifully performed as well. And I'd be amazed if nobody recognised. If there's anybody you could go and find who didn't recognise Tracks of My Tears if you played it to them.
I played it a couple of times earlier today, and it just still sounds so great. The intro, the clever intro, the full production of it, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and, Smokey's voice, where he is. I think this was one of the powerful aspects of so many Motown artists, certainly true of Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Diana Ross, certainly, Levi Stubbs, that It sounds like they are living what they're singing. Yeah. They just really live the song.
Which is why, I guess why it got to be called soul music, isn't it?
I guess of course it would have done. Just such an influence on the Beatles, the early work, especially of groups like the Marvelettes, but particularly Smokey Robinson influenced John Lennon so much. And, I'm so grateful to my dad and to some of my cousins, because it was lovely listening to the Beatles in a bubble, but when it was sort of explained to me that, look, this is how they created this, because they were, they were listening to these records, look here, and then they went from that and created this, and you could see the link, and it was like being passed on, like a baton being passed on through generations,
Well, let's leave Detroit for the moment and come dashing back to England, and it's not the thing, isn't it, but certain English cities are far more prone to producing great pop acts than others. I mean, if you think of Liverpool, and we were just talking about the Beatles there, Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, China Crisis, and of course, most famous of all out of Liverpool, Gerry and the Pacemakers. Or then they take Sheffield, the Human League, ABC, Def Leppard, Tony Christie, Joe Cocker. But you see, I'm originally from Nottingham. I was Nottingham born and bred. But other than Tinder sticks and paper lace, we've got nothing. We've got nothing to brag about. It's hard to identify what makes the difference. But anyway, back to Sheffield. We shouldn't, of course, omit from that list the mighty Pulp, who were a little later than some of those other acts, but certainly now firmly established as really, I suppose, one of the only truly original bands to make their mark on that Britpop era. And Jarvis Cocker now, I think, firmly on that list of greatest living Englishmen. I think he could lay a claim to that. So not surprisingly, Pulp had its full quotient of brilliant frontmen and songwriters in Jarvis, which meant one of the earlier members of Pulp, before they hit the big time, Richard Hawley, had to branch out on his own to gain proper recognition, really, for his talent, which is considerable. Now, pleasingly, he is every bit as good as his city mates, if there is such a thing as a city mate, his fellow Sheffieldians, Joe and Jarvis Cocker, Phil Oakey, Martin Fry and the rest. Richard Hawley can add his name to that plinth. Certainly. With his vintage personal style, he looks very much like an original rockabilly, and that lachrymose baritone voice that he uses, the kitchen sink drama lyrics, one really, really could see him as Yorkshire's Morrissey in a way, but that's probably unfair, because he's very much his own man, and that's really clear from his heartbreaking but deeply endearing song, For Your Lover Give Some Time. Now, if there's a better summary of man's clumsiness with affairs of the heart, and I don't mean mankind, I mean the male gender's clumsiness with affairs of the heart, and regret at those failings, then I haven't heard it. I would give up these cigarettes, maybe drink a little less. Hawley croons in a tender but sort of pathos-laden plea to convince his girl that he does genuinely care about her, but in a blokily hopeless sort of way, and has no real way of showing it other than to have a fewer pints at the pub and maybe stop sparking up quite so often. Or try the opening verse. It was your birthday yesterday. I gave a gift that almost took your breath away, but to be honest, I nearly left it on the train. That sort of captures that uselessness that he's trying to overcome and not quite succeeding. For Your Lover would comfortably soundtrack, I think, a 1950s Brit movie set in a northern mining town starring Alan Bates and Rita Tushingham. It doesn't, but it could. But what it does do is sit just perfectly on our pretend iPod. So that's my pick this week. It's Richard Hawley's gorgeous For Your Lover Gives Some Time.
Yeah, I played this about an hour or so before we started the podcast. And I guess it's lovely, isn't it? I mean, he's a crooner.
He is a crooner,
He's a crooner, certainly, in the old-fashioned sense. I don't know much about him. I mean, I know the background and where he came from and, his bio, as it were. But I know he's very successful. What... Do you know sort of what his market? What is the market for his music? Because it's not something that's going to, you know, the people aren't going to be pogoing up and down to it in front of it, at Glastonbury.
No, but I. But I think,
who buys this?
I think maybe back in the glamping field at Glastonbury late at night with a scented candle on the go, then sort of former word readers and middle-aged people of some taste and distinction would happily put some Richard Hawley on there. He's not always that mellow pace, I have to say, but on the whole, he is a crooner of ballads. But I think, you know, I think that's his market there. Yeah.
Yeah, and good for him. And he's, I mean, it's just tremendously good at it. It's as simple as that. It's just great songs, well written, well performed, and he has a great voice. So you know, I think he's probably got a huge career. And I imagine, I mean, I'm not someone who listens to modern music radio at all. They don't play this on Radio 3. But I imagine, you know, this is what they call very much crossover. I imagine you're as likely to hear this on Ken Bruce on Radio 2 as much as you are with Laura Laverne on Six Music.
Exactly right, actually. Yes. I think it's easy listening with enormous credibility, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way at all. And you're right. He's carved out a really fine niche for himself, and performs very well within it. We can even forgive him for selling For Your Lover to an ice cream commercial. I won't mention the brand of ice cream. They don't need the promotion. But he was on a famous ice cream commercial. He wasn't, but his song was. But you know, fair enough.
We've all got to make a living.
Exactly.
I think these two tracks sit really nicely together. Smokey Robinson, Tracks of My Tears, and Richard Hawley. Yeah. For Your Lover, Give Some Time.
Yeah, another couple of smashes, as you say, inserted delicately into our eternal playlist, which I'm afraid means our team of highly trained chipmunks are, as we speak, fueling up the Learjet and preparing to whip us off to the Maltese Orange Gala, which is taking place tonight. Just time to thank the verdant Terence Deckham.
Be seeing you.
Yes, and of course, thank you to Rona for the introductions earlier on. And as ever, to you, our favourite listener, much gratitude to you. More, of course, at therockingvicar.com, and we're back very soon. Till then, bye-bye.
Mother. and with my thoughts I'm left alone. Now and then I think how strange our love has grown. For your lover, if sometime I will give up these cigarettes, stay at home and watch you mend the tears in your dress, have your name in a rose tattooed across my chest, and be your lover for all time. Maybe I will drink a little less, come home early and not complain about the dead, and give you flowers from the graveyard now and then. For your lover, give some time.
Listening to a Dacom Shore media production.